I'm John Batzer, visiting with Professor James Rahm. Violence is ahead. It's just like a play. You show a tyrant in the first act, you know things are going to go badly by the third act, and by the fifth, everybody dies. Plato and the Tyrant is the book, The Fall of Greece's Greatest Dynasty and the Making of a Philosophic Masterpiece. Dion is in exile, but he lives very well. He's rich, he travels around, and in his travels, I take it he's talking to people about, you know, we got to do something about Syracuse. It's in the hands of a bunch of characters who are dangerous to all of us. Plato meets him at the Olympic Games. Is that when they next have a conversation?
That's right.
And what does Plato learn that Dion's up to?
So during the 5 years that Dion has been in exile, the tyrant, Dionysius, has confiscated his entire estate and is more or less holding his family hostage. And when Dion learns of this from Plato at the Olympic Games, he determines he cannot put up with this any longer. He's got to invade Sicily and overthrow the regime.
And therein lies the plot. Plato is observing all this. Does he approve of it?
Not according to his own testimony in the seventh letter, and we can talk later about what that letter represents. But Plato describes this conversation and says that he refused to take any part in a coup attempt and condemned it as an evil and offered to mediate between these two warring halves of the family and try to get them back together again.
Now, the family, I said before, it's very complicated how they were all related. But Dion, does he know that his wife is no longer his wife, that he's been deprived of his, what's back? What did Dionysius do to Dion's family?
So to excise Dion from the family, he broke up the marriage to his sister and married the sister off to a regime loyalist, someone whose fidelity he could count on. And also, as I mentioned, stripped Dion of the income from his property and even sold off the property so as to essentially make Dion an outcast and presumably prevent him from ever coming back to Syracuse.
Now, Plato, having said that I'm not going to get involved in war, decides to make one more voyage to Syracuse. What a character he is. Okay, so what does he hope to achieve by going back? I know he's going to plead Dion's case, but what does he hope to see?
Well, his principal motive was, as you say, to try to get Dion reinstated, because Dion himself argued that Plato could do more good for him by going to the tyrant's court and appearing in person and making the case. But beyond that, he seems not to have given up until the very last minute on the project of enlightening the ruler and making him into a legitimate monarch, a constitutional monarch. He went the third time with some hope that that was still possible.
Now, it's 361. Plato knows that there's a plot back in Athens or in the whole of the Hellenistic world, because Dion is hiring Spartans, he's hiring troops, or at least he's talking to lots of people who are alienated from Syracuse. He knows that. Does he convey that to Dionysius? You know, you need to do something here. Things are going to go badly for you. Or does he pretend that he doesn't know and he makes the pitch entirely in terms of family affair?
So it's not clear what Plato knew at the time of his third visit. It's possible he was not yet aware of any plans on Dion's part to overthrow the tyranny. He later writes a letter after his return to Athens in which he does hint very darkly at the coming of this invasion and even gloats a little bit that Dionysius had imagined something that was now about to come true. That is, his worst fears were about to be realized.
The philosopher king is a term that they didn't use in Greece, I learned from James. In fact, it was invented at the end of the 18th century. I'm going to assume that it was James Madison that invented. Just make that assumption. But in any event, what did Plato make of what was going on? Did it inform the Republic, or did he regard it as outside his interests?
I think it very much informed the Republic. And in fact, Plato left us evidence of that in that he has Socrates, who's the principal speaker in the Republic, say at one point, the way to learn about tyranny is to listen to a man who's lived under the roof of a tyrant. That seems to be an unmistakable reference to Plato's own experience. So the Republic presents a very harsh attack on tyranny and what Plato calls the tyrannical man, the man who wants to be a tyrant, and instead exalts this figure of the philosopher king, the person we call the philosopher king. And to make that distinction so sharply and to condemn the tyrant as a source of terrible evil, I think it comes directly out of the Syracuse experience.
So we don't know if Plato knew that there was a building tragedy. We don't have any idea. The city of Syracuse right now at the moment of 361, as Plato departs, is 200,000 people, maybe more, has a wall entirely built around it. It's extremely secure, has a very large fleet, has a very large army, is rich, is chopping its way up the boot. Did I leave anything out? It's a powerful state.
Indeed.
And it's known throughout all of Italy as a state that could threaten us. How far afield were they threatened? Were they threatened in Athens?
Well, we have a speech by an Athenian orator already in 388, so some 25 years before the time that you're describing, in which the orator Lysias, an Athenian, but from a expat family that had left Syracuse, describes the tyrant of Syracuse as a threat to all of Greece, equal in power to the king of Persia. So, yes, there were people in Greece who regarded this as a threat to freedom. However, Athens at this time had a very shifting foreign policy and was actually allied with Dionysius so as to protect its own interests in Greece.
Professor James Romm, Plato and the Tyrant, when we come back, the invasion.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.